This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 7 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. You can check it out at CertFuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's great stuff. So, you know, usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of like precision.
Right.
Like you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points and says, you know, there it is.
Yeah.
It's incredibly binary.
Right, yeah. It's either broken or it's not. And as humans, we kind of crave that, you know?
Yeah.
We like things to be visible and easily categorized into neat little boxes.
Exactly. But then you step into the world of broker-dealer regulation, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just completely useless.
Oh, totally useless.
Right. Like, we're looking at a compliance landscape that is honestly pretty murky. If you walk onto a trading floor, behind all those flashing green and red screens, there is this massive invisible fortress of rules.
Yeah.
And if that fortress fails, the entire financial system starts to crack.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. Because at the end of the day, you aren't regulating machines, right? You are regulating human behavior.
Which is messy.
Very messy. And human behavior is never binary.
Hmm.
So managing the risk of what a stressed or greedy or like panicked person might do with millions of dollars is just incredibly complex.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because our mission today is to map out that invisible fortress. We are diving deep into account supervision and approvals.
Yes.
Now, if you are listening to this while prepping for the Series 7, you already know this represents a massive chunk of your exam.
Huge chunk.
Yeah, it's about 9%, pulling heavily from Chapter 2. This is the stuff that can absolutely make or break your score.
It really can. And to really understand these rules, we can't just read them off a page like a textbook. The rules don't exist in a vacuum, you know?
Right.
They're written because somebody somewhere did something terrible and the regulators had to step in and fix it. So we need to understand the actual people living inside this system.
Yeah. To keep us from falling asleep in the regulatory weeds here, we are going to build a little cinematic universe today.
I love this.
I want you to picture a specific branch office.
Okay.
At the other of it is Prudent Paula.
Okay, Paul.
She is a stressed out, overworked Series 24 general securities principal. Her entire life's mission is just keeping the firm from getting shut down by regulators. She drinks way too much coffee and hasn't slept a full 8 hours since, like, 2018.
Poor Paula. I mean, she has arguably the most difficult job in the building.
Yeah.
The liability she carries is just immense.
Immense liability, largely because of the guy sitting right outside her glass office.
Yeah.
And that is Reckless Rick.
Oh, boy. Rick?
Yeah, Reckless Rick. He is an overly eager, fast-talking, registered rep who will cut literally every compliance corner in the book just to close a sale and earn a commission.
He's the walking regulatory red flag.
Yes.
Every firm has one,
yeah.
And they are the exact reason Paula's hair is going gray.
And finally, on the other end of Rick's phone line, we have frantic Fiona.
Ah, the customer.
Yes. She is their most chaotic retail customer. She loves day trading meme stocks. She always conveniently forgets her ID, and she constantly demands weird, sketchy wire transfers.
Perfect.
So we have Paula, Rick, and Fiona. They are going to be our guides today.
I love it. Let's start with the foundation. Because before Reckless Rick can even like pick up the phone to pitch frantic Fiona a terrible stock, Paula's firm has to actually build a system to oversee him.
Right. They need a playbook. But I have to ask, like, if Rick goes completely rogue, if he starts running a Ponzi scheme out of the break room, does Paula automatically go to jail just because she's his boss?
Well, not necessarily. And this is a core concept you will see tested heavily.
Okay.
The regulatory standard is that a firm error supervisory system must be reasonably designed to achieve compliance with securities laws.
Wait, reasonably designed? That feels like a very deliberate choice of words. Why not perfectly designed?
Because the SEC and FINRA, they live in the real world.
Yeah.
What's fascinating here is that the regulators know perfection is just impossible. A reasonably designed system is not a magical force field. If Reckless Rick actively hides his illicit activities, if he actively lies and circumvents the controls, Prudent Paula's firm might actually still be completely in the clear.
Really?
Yeah. But, and this is a massive but, they have to be able to prove to regulators that their supervisory system was logically built, meticulously documented, and actively enforced.
Okay, let me try an analogy. It's like a football playbook.
Okay.
The coach writes up this brilliant, foolproof offensive strategy. The offensive line blocks perfectly. The receivers run the exact right routes. But the quarterback just trips over his own feet, drops the ball, and the other team scores.
Right. A complete fumble.
Right. The regulators aren't going to punish the coach for a clumsy quarterback, provided the coach was actually running a legitimate supervised practice and calling real plays. But you have to, like, prove you have that playbook.
That is exactly how you should think about it. The system worked, but the individual failed. But in our world, you can't just tell Finery had a playbook, I swear.
Yeah, they want receipts.
Exactly. You have to show it to them. That playbook is officially called the Written Supervisory Procedures, or WSPs.
WSPs. Okay, let's get into the weeds on these. What exactly has to go into Paula's WSPs? Can she just type up a Word document that says, you know, the compliance department will check all the trades whenever they have some free time?
Absolutely not. And this is a major area where test takers get tripped up. WSPs must be painstakingly specific.
How specific?
They must identify specific individuals responsible for each review. You cannot use a vague catch-all job title like compliance team.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you need to designate a specific person or a very clear named role. You have to list the specific activities they will review, the exact frequency of that review, and precisely how they will document that the review actually happened.
Okay, so it has to sound something like, Prudent Paula, acting as the Series 24 principal, will review all new equity account openings on a daily basis by physically initialing and dating the new account form. Like, it needs that level of granular detail.
Exactly. It has to be actionable. And a physical or readily accessible electronic copy of these WSPs must be kept at every OSJ.
Okay, hold that thought. OSJ. I know that stands for Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction, but before we define it, let's talk about WSP updates.
Sure.
Let's say Paula's firm wrote an airtight set of WSPs 5 years ago. They were flawless. But last month, they decided to start letting Reckless Rick trade complex options for clients. The old WSPs don't mention options anywhere. Is Paula in trouble here?
Oh, massive trouble.
Yeah.
WSPs are living documents. They must be updated promptly whenever there is a change in business activities, a change in supervisory personnel, or a change in regulations.
Okay, so you can't just set it and forget it.
No, not at all. If you add a new product line like options and you don't immediately update your WSPs to reflect exactly how you're going to supervise Rick trading those options, you're committing a violation before he even places his first trade.
Okay, let's pivot back to where Paula sits. You mentioned the OSJ. Listeners, I want to ask you a direct question right now. I want you to pause the audio for a second and think about this. If Prudent Paula's office has the authority to officially approve Frantic Fiona's brand new trading account, what kind of office is it?
Give them a beat.
Did you get it? It's an OSJ.
Right. That is the ultimate differentiator. You have to understand the regulatory hierarchy. You have the OSJ at the very top, then you have standard branch offices below that, and then non-branch locations at the very bottom.
Okay, so OSJ is the big boss office.
Yeah, every OSJ is technically a branch office, but not every branch office is an OSJ.
So what elevates a regular run-of-the-mill branch office into the mighty OSJ?
It all comes down to authority and risk. An office becomes an OSJ if it does things like approving new accounts, reviewing and endorsing customer orders, maintaining custody of customer funds or securities, or if it has supervisory responsibility over other branch offices.
Basically, if they have the power to make the big decisions.
Exactly. If an office holds those keys to the kingdom, it is an OSJ.
No.
And because it holds that power, it must have an on-site, registered principal like Prudent Paula present on a regular and routine basis.
What about the bottom of that hierarchy, a non-branch location? Let's say Reckless Rick has a great quarter, he makes a ton of commissions, and decides he wants to work remotely from a rented ski cabin in Aspen for 3 weeks.
Must be nice.
Right. Does Paula have to fill out a bunch of FINRA paperwork to register his ski cabin as an official branch office?
No, she doesn't. There's a very specific carve-out for this. A non-branch location used for fewer than 30 business days a year is exempt from branch registration.
Okay, so there's a limit.
Yeah, as long as Rick packs up his laptop and leaves Aspen before he hits that 30 business day threshold, it remains a non-branch location.
I love that. The 30-day ski cabin rule. Okay, so Paula is sitting in her OSJ. She is completely exhausted. She has a stack of 50 new account forms sitting on her desk waiting for approval.
Typical Tuesday.
Yeah. Her administrative assistant is brilliant. He's been at the firm for 20 years. He knows the rules better than anyone, but he's not formally registered. Can Paula just hand him the stack and say, hey, you know what to look for? Just rubber stamp these for me today so I can sleep.
Never. I don't care if the assistant have been there for 50 years. The delegation rule is incredibly strict on this. You absolutely cannot delegate supervisory duties to unregistered personnel.
No exceptions.
In the eyes of FIRA, experience does not matter one bit. Registration status is all that matters.
Wow. Is there literally any exception to that? What if she just wants him to, like, sort her emails?
Well, sorting emails is actually where the one narrow carve-out exists.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A principal can delegate certain correspondence and internal communication review functions to an unregistered person. But, and this is a critical distinction, the principal remains ultimately responsible for the review.
Okay, so Paula can have her unregistered assistant pre-screen the emails and flag the important ones. But if the assistant accidentally misses an email where Reckless Rick is promising guaranteed 20% returns to Fiona, Paula is still the one whose head is on the chopping block.
Exactly. She can delegate the task of reading, but she cannot delegate the liability. She owns the risk entirely.
That makes total sense. All right, so we've built this whole WSP playbook. We know where the OSJs are. We know Paula can't outsource her job. But how do we know Reckless Rick is actually reading the playbook? I mean, paper is just paper. How does the firm know he isn't just using the WSP manual as a coaster for his iced coffee?
This brings us to a concept that students mix up constantly on the exam. It's the difference between the supervision rule and the supervisory control rule.
Wait, isn't supervision just supervision? Why are there two rules that sound exactly the same?
It's kind of like meta-supervision. Let's break it down. The supervision rule is everything we just talked about. It's the act of establishing the system, writing the WSPs, and designating prudent Paula to watch Rick.
Writing the playbook.
Right. But the supervisory control rule requires the firm to designate one or more specific principles to actively test whether those procedures actually work.
Oh, testing the system.
Exactly. Are the WSPs actually catching violations, or are they just a useless pile of paper? It is literally the supervision of the supervision.
Okay, so it's like hiring an auditor to watch the security guard to make sure the security guard is actually watching the cameras.
That's a great way to look at it.
And this testing process generates a report, right?
Yes, it generates what is known as the Supervisory Control Annual Report.
Now, here is a classic exam trap, folks. This is where they try to get you. Who does this annual report go to? If you guess it goes straight to FIMARA or the SEC, you get the question wrong. So who does it go to?
It goes directly to the firm's senior management, the CEO, the board of directors.
Wait, why not the regulator? Shouldn't they be the ones reading it?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's about forcing accountability to the very top of the corporate ladder. The CEO needs to know if their invisible fortress has holes in it.
That makes sense.
Right. The regulators expect the firm's leadership to own their compliance posture, not just blindly outsource it to the compliance department and play dumb if something goes wrong.
And there's a surprising fact here that I want to highlight, because the test writers love this nuance. If the firm is an absolute behemoth, specifically, if they report $200 million or more in gross revenue, they have to add a massive amount of extra detail to this report.
They do. They have to explicitly test 6 specific compliance areas. And do you know how they measure that $200 million threshold?
It's based on their FOCIS report, right?
Yes, but specifically their revenue from the prior calendar year FOCIS report.
Let's pause right there. Define a FOCIS report for me. We're throwing acronyms around and I want to make sure we're clear.
Good call. FOCIS S stands for Financial and Operational Combined Uniform Single Report.
That is a mouthful.
It really is. You don't really need to memorize the full acronym for the Series 7. Just think of it as the broker-dealer's ultimate financial report card that they have to file with the SEC and FINRA. It basically proves they have enough net capital to stay in business.
Got it. So if last year's financial report card showed $200 million or more, this year's supervisory control report has to be on steroids. Why?
Because a firm of that size poses a systemic risk to the market. If a mom-and-pop broker goes under, it's sad, right?
Yeah.
But if a firm doing $200 million in gross revenue collapses because their compliance was a joke, it ripples through the entire economy, so they face heightened scrutiny.
Speaking of scrutiny, Paula can't just sit in her office all day reading reports. She has to physically inspect her branch locations. Let's hit the testable numbers on inspection frequencies, because these are guaranteed points on the exam.
Absolutely. Let's start at the top of the hierarchy. For an OSJ, or any supervisory branch office, inspections must happen at least annually.
Once a year. Why so frequent?
Because, like we said earlier, the OSJ holds the keys to the kingdom. They are approving accounts and handling funds. The risk of something catastrophic happening is much higher there, so they need constant surveillance.
Makes sense. What about a standard non-supervisory branch office? Let's say it's just a suburban office where Rick meets clients, but he can't actually approve anything or hold their money.
Since the risk profile is lower, that office must be inspected at least every 3 years.
And what about Rick's ski cabin in Aspen, the non-branch location?
For non-branches, there is no hard statutory number, like 1 year or 3 years. The rule simply says it must be inspected on a regular periodic schedule.
Kind of vague.
It is. Mm-hmm. The firm has to define a reasonable schedule in their WSPs based on the nature of the business happening there, and then actually stick to it.
All right, I need everybody to wake up, shake it out, roll your shoulders. Do not let the word annual blur in your brain right now. We have a direct comparison coming up, and they are going to try to trick you with this on test day. The annual compliance review versus the annual compliance meeting.
Oh, this is a big one. They sound nearly identical, but they serve totally different purposes, and you have to know the difference.
Break them down for me. I'm going to propose an idea, and you tell me if I'm right. The annual compliance review is when Paula pulls Rick into a conference room, sits him in a folding chair, and lectures him about insider trading for an hour. Right.
Completely wrong. You just described the annual compliance meeting.
Okay. Explain the difference.
The annual compliance review is a broad systemic audit of the entire firm's business lines. It's the firm looking in the mirror. They're reviewing their overall processes to detect and prevent violations. It's about the business itself.
Okay, so review equals the business.
Yes. The annual compliance meeting, on the other hand, is a mandatory individual interview or group seminar that every single registered rep like Reckless Rick must attend every single year to discuss compliance matters relevant to their specific job.
So, meeting equals the rep. Review equals the business. Do not confuse them. Since we're talking about our favorite rep, let's talk about the hiring process. Let's rewind the clock. Paula wants to hire Reckless Rick. What are her deadlines for checking his background?
Well, before hiring anyone, a firm has an obligation to investigate their character, reputation, and qualifications. Specifically, they must review the applicant's U-5 within 60 days.
Okay, the U-5 is the termination notice from their old firm. Paula has 60 days to review it. What about the new application?
They must verify the accuracy of the new U4, the actual application for registration, within 30 calendar days.
Let's explore the why here, because if you understand the why, you don't have to memorize the numbers. Why does Paula get 60 days for the U5, but only 30 days for the U4? Why the discrepancy?
Think about the mechanics of how you verify these documents. Verifying the U4 involves a search of reasonably available public records, things like criminal background checks, bankruptcies, civil judgments.
Right.
In the digital age, a firm can run those searches very quickly. So FineRA says you have 30 days, get it done.
Right, 30 days for the stuff you can just Google or pull from a database.
Exactly. But the U5 comes from the applicant's previous broker-dealer. It contains the official reason they left their last job. And sometimes former employers drag their feet. Or maybe there's a dispute over why the rep was fired and the applicant has to track the document down. Regulators give you a 60-day window to account for that potential friction between the old firm and the new firm.
That is brilliant. 30 days for public records because it's fast. 60 days for the U5 because old bosses can be petty and slow. I'll never forget that.
It definitely helps to think of it that way.
Okay, we are moving into the real meat of the deep dive. The danger zones. The WSP system is tested, Rick is hired, and now frantic Fiona bursts through the front doors of the branch. She wants to open every type of account imaginable.
Here we go.
Let's start simple, a general cash account. She just wants to buy some mutual funds with her own money.
For a standard general account, prudent Paula simply reviews the new account form for completeness, accuracy, and appropriateness.
Standard stuff.
Yeah. Is the name right? Is the address right? Do the investment objectives make sense for a cash account? It's very straightforward.
Basic stuff. But Fiona gets bored easily. She wants to trade on leverage. She wants to borrow money from the firm to buy twice as much stock. She wants a margin account. What's the extra layer of supervision here?
This requires formal principal approval, plus the customer must sign the margin agreement and the hypothecation agreement.
Pause right there. Define hypothecation. That's a scary legal word.
It sounds complex, but it's exactly what you do when you get a mortgage. Hypothecation is simply the act of pledging an asset as collateral for a loan.
Okay.
In a margin account, Fiona is pledging her securities as collateral, so the broker-dealer will lend her cash. If she doesn't pay the loan back, the firm can just sell her stock to cover the debt.
Okay, so she has to sign the hypothecation agreement. But here is the red herring they will throw at you on the exam. Fiona is acting frantic. She wants to buy 1,000 shares of a stock on margin right this very second because she read a tweet about it, but she hasn't signed the hypothecation paperwork yet. Does Rick have to physically block her from making that first trade until she signs?
No, he doesn't. And this trips people up because it feels wrong. But the rule specifically states that the signatures must be secured promptly after the initial transaction. A missing signature does not block Fiona's first trade.
Wait, why? Why let her trade with borrowed money before signing the contract? That seems crazy.
Because markets move at lightning speed. Regulators don't want a bureaucratic paperwork delay to cause a retail investor to miss a massive market opportunity, so they give a tiny grace period. But if Rick fails to get her to sign it immediately afterward, the account is frozen and the firm is in massive violation.
So the first hit is free, but you better get the ink on the paper before the closing bell rings.
Basically, yeah.
Now, Fiona wants to get even riskier. She wants to trade options.
What's fascinating here is how options have an entirely separate, heavily fortified layer of specialized supervision. Options are derivatives. They carry unique, asymmetric risks like extreme leverage, time decay, and even infinite loss potential on certain strategies.
Right.
A standard general principle might not fully grasp the mathematical danger of what Fiona is trying to do.
So are you telling me prudent Paula, with her hard-earned Series 24 General Securities Principal License, cannot approve this options account by herself?
That is exactly what I'm telling you.
Oh.
A Series 24 alone is not enough to clear options. Options accounts must be approved by someone with specific options expertise.
Who would that be?
That means a branch office manager, a Series 4 Registered Options Principal, commonly called an ROP, or someone with a Series 910 General Securities Sales Supervisor License. A GSSS.
Okay, let's say Paula is the official branch manager, but she only has her Series 24. Does Fiona have to wait to trade?
No, Paula can conditionally approve it as the branch manager, but the approval must be kicked up and reviewed by an actual ROP or GSSS within 10 business days. That 10-day window is your regulatory backstop.
10 business days to get the ROP's blessing, and when the ROP looks at Fiona's file, what exactly are they checking?
They are looking at a trifecta, three specific things: her financial status, her investment objectives, and her options experience.
All three. So if Fiona has a massive income and she lists aggressive speculation as her objective, but she admits she has 0 months of options trading experience, the ROP needs to factor that lack of experience in.
Right.
They might restrict her to basic strategies like covered calls and forbid her from writing naked puts.
Precisely. They have a duty to protect her from her own inexperience.
Let's shift gears. What about municipal securities? Fiona suddenly cares about tax-free income and wants to buy bonds issued by her local city.
Municipal securities exist in a slightly different regulatory universe. They fall under the MSRB, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board. Overall, supervision of a muni business requires a Series 53 principle. But here's the major difference for your exam. Municipal transactions require daily review and written approval by a designated principal.
Daily? That is way faster than standard general supervision. Why is the MSRB so aggressive about daily reviews?
Historically, the municipal bond market has been very opaque. It trades over the counter, pricing can be tricky, and there are unique political and tax implications.
Right.
The regulators want a principal looking at those trades immediately to ensure reps aren't marking up the prices unfairly or stuffing unsuitable bonds into retail accounts.
The MSRB does not mess around. All right, let's do a direct comparison that I guarantee will show up on the exam. Discretionary authority versus time and price discretion.
Oh, this is a critical distinction. It all boils down to one question. Who is actually making the investment decision?
Okay, let's do a scenario. Listeners, pay attention to the wording here. Scenario A, Fiona is running out the door to a weekend yoga retreat. She yells to Rick, "Hey, buy 100 shares of XYZ stock at the best price today." What is that?
That is time and price discretion. Let's look at the elements. Fiona specified the asset XYZ stock. She specified the action buy. And she specified the amount, 100 shares.
So she gave him all the main details.
Exactly. The only variables she left up to Rick were the exact time of day to execute it and the exact price to get.
Does Rick need Fiona to sign a formal written discretionary authorization form for that?
No, he doesn't. Time and price discretion can be given verbally. But here's the catch. It is only good until the end of the business day. If Rick doesn't find a good entry point and fails to buy it today, he cannot buy it tomorrow without calling Fiona back and getting a new verbal order.
Okay, scenario B. Fiona says, "Rick, I love XYZ stock. Buy 100 shares whenever it looks good this week."
Whenever it looks good this week. That phrase crosses a massive regulatory line. Because the duration of the order extends beyond the current business day, this is no longer time and price. This is now full discretion.
Why does the duration matter so much? Why is tomorrow so much more dangerous than today?
Because if a broker can hold an order open for a week or a month and execute it whenever they feel like it, they are essentially acting as a portfolio manager. And managing a portfolio requires a much higher fiduciary standard, entirely different registrations.
That makes perfect sense. So what does full discretion actually require?
Three things. Prior written authorization from the customer, written acceptance of the account by a principal like Paula, and prompt written approval of each individual discretionary order by a principal.
Extending the timeline completely changes the regulatory burden. Are there literally any exceptions where time and price can last longer than a single day without requiring full written discretion?
Yes, there is one major carve-out, but you have to read the question carefully. Institutional accounts, not retail, institutional, can issue valid good till canceled, or GTC, instructions on a not held basis. That extends the time and price discretion.
Okay, but for our characters.
Right. Remember, Fiona is a retail customer, so this exception does not apply to her.
Not held. If you see an institutional account and the phrase not held, that is your cue for the exception.
Exactly.
All right, let's move into safeguarding assets. Let's lock it down. Fiona accounts are all approved. She just walked into the branch, handed Rick a cashier's check for $50,000, and slapped down a stack of physical stock certificates.
Yeah.
How does the Invisible Fortress ensure Rick doesn't use her money to fund a new ping pong table for the break room, or worse, use her assets to cover the firm's own bad trades?
This brings us to a foundational SEC rule, which is the customer protection rule. Think of it as an impenetrable firewall. Broker-dealers must maintain physical possession or control of a customer's fully paid securities, as well as their excess margin securities.
So they can't just mix it all up.
Right. These assets cannot be commingled with the firm's assets under any circumstances, and they absolutely cannot be used to collateralize the firm's own proprietary trading.
Let's play out the worst-case scenario. What if Paula's firm goes completely bankrupt? They made terrible bets. The creditors are knocking on the door. What happens to Fiona's $50,000 in cash? Does it just vanish into the bankruptcy proceedings?
No, and that is exactly why the customer protection rule requires the firm to maintain what is called a special reserve bank account.
Special reserve bank account.
Yes. This is an account set up at a bank that is legally designated for the exclusive benefit of customers. The broker-dealer must constantly calculate the net cash they owe to customers, and they must hold that exact amount of cash or highly qualified securities in this untouchable reserve account.
So if the firm goes belly up, Fiona's retail cash is sitting in this separate, walled-off reserve account, completely safe from the firm's creditors.
Precisely. It prevents a broker-dealer's insolvency from wiping out the retail investors who trusted them. It's the ultimate safety net.
Okay, I have another direct question for the listener. Think fast on this one. Frantic Fiona calls Rick. She is in a panic. She says, "Oh my God, I forgot my brother's birthday. I need you to cut a check for $1,000 from my account and mail it directly to his house." Now, Wick already has general trading authorization on her account. Can he just cut the check and solve her problem?
Give him a second to think.
Got your answer. And no, he cannot.
A general trading authorization only allows Rick to buy and sell securities.
Yep.
It does not allow him to act like her personal APM. To draw a negotiable instrument like a check from a customer's account, the firm needs specific written authorization from the customer for that exact specific action.
You cannot just move money out of the fortress because you have trading privileges. What about wiring funds? Let's say she wants to wire money to a third party.
Transmittals of funds require a very rigid two-step safeguard. You must verify the customer's instructions before the transfer is initiated, and you must confirm the transmittal with the customer after it's completed.
Verify before, confirm after. It's like an anti-fraud sandwich. You have to trap the transaction between two layers of verification.
That's a good way to remember it.
Okay, we are moving into the messy stuff. Breaking up, refusing, restricting, and closing accounts. Honestly, Fiona is causing too much trouble for Paula.
I don't blame her.
She's ignoring margin calls, making sketchy deposits, and refusing to update her contact info. How does the firm stop her? Let's start with mandatory refusals. When is a firm legally forced to say no?
First is a CIP failure. CIP stands for Customer Identification Program. Thanks to the Patriot Act, if Fiona refuses to show her government ID or provide her social security number, the firm cannot open the account. period.
They just have to turn her away.
Exactly. Second is an OFAC match.
Oh, this is a big one. OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. Let's say Fiona's name pops up on the specially designated nationals list. She's on a terror watch list or sanctioned by the U.S. government. What happens?
Here is where they try to catch you on the exam.
Yeah.
You must block the account A&D reported to OFAC. It is a two-step mandatory action.
Okay, both.
Yes. You cannot just block it quietly and hope she goes away. And you cannot report it while secretly letting her finish her trades. Block and report.
What if Fiona just wants to trade highly speculative penny stocks, but she has a fixed income, zero risk tolerance, and she refuses to sign a document acknowledging the massive risks?
That is called unacknowledged unsuitability. If the activity is wildly unsuitable for her profile and she flat out refuses to acknowledge the disclosures, the firm must restrict the activity to protect themselves from a future lawsuit.
Okay, let's talk about the big guns. SARs. Suspicious activity reports. These are triggered at $5,000 or more involving suspected illegal activity, money laundering, tax evasion.
Right.
I'm going to paint a ridiculous scenario, but I want you to walk me through it. Fiona walks into the branch. She plops down a duffel bag containing exactly $6,000 in physical cash. But the cash is completely covered in craft glitter. And she demands it be wired immediately to an unknown shell company in the Cayman Islands.
That is highly suspicious.
Rick thinks so too. It hits the $5,000 threshold. It makes absolutely no economic sense. So the firm files a SAR with FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. A week later, Fiona comes marching into the branch, gets right in Rick's face, and yells, "Hey, my wire got delayed. Did you report me to the government?" What does Rick do?
Rick legally has to keep his mouth shut. This is a massive pitfall in the exam.
Oh.
Tipping off a customer about a SAR is strictly prohibited by federal law.
Wow.
The confidentiality of a SAR is absolute. He cannot confirm it. He cannot deny it. Even if she screams at him, he has to play dumb.
Why so strict? Why can't he just say, "Yeah, Fiona, the glittery cash was a bit much"?
Because SARs are used to track global syndicates, terrorists, and cartels.
Mm.
If a local broker tips off a money launderer that the feds are watching, that launderer immediately moves the money, destroys the evidence, and vanishes.
Absolute secrecy. I love that. Now, let's look at trading restrictions. This is a direct comparison you have to nail. Free riding versus the pattern day trader rule. Let's start with free riding. What is it?
Free riding happens in a cash account. Remember how settlement works. When you buy a stock, it takes a day T plus one for the trade to settle and for you to actually owe the money. Let's say Fiona buys 100 shares of Apple, but before she actually deposits the cash to pay for those shares, the stock price spikes and she sells them to capture a quick profit.
Wait, she bought stock with money she didn't have and then sold it?
Yes. She is riding the firm's capital for free. She generated a profit without ever actually putting her own money at risk.
Regulators must despise that. You're basically using the broker-dealer as an uncollateralized casino. What's the penalty?
The penalty is a 90-day freeze on her account.
Now, let's clarify that. Does a freeze mean she is locked out and cannot trade at all?
No, and that's a very common misconception. She can still trade, but for the next 90 days, she is restricted to a prepay-only basis. She must have the fully settled cash sitting in her account before she's allowed to execute any new purchase. She loses the privilege of T plus one grace periods.
Okay, so 90-day prepay freeze for free riding in a cash account. How is that different from a pattern day trader?
The pattern day trader, or PDT rule, applies to margin accounts, not cash accounts. If Fiona executes four or more day trades within a rolling five business day period, she is officially flagged as a pattern day trader.
Four trades in 5 days. Memorize that. What happens when she gets flagged?
Once flagged, she is required to maintain a minimum equity of $25,000 in her account at all times.
At all times, not just when the closing bell rings.
At all times, intraday. If her equity dips to $24,999 at 2 p.m., she receives a day trading margin call.
Let's talk about the why again. Why $25,000? Why not $10,000 or $50,000?
Because day trading on margin is incredibly risky. You can lose massive amounts of money in minutes. Regulators decided that $25,000 is the mathematical line in the sand that proves you have enough of a capital cushion to absorb violent intraday losses without defaulting on the broker-dealer's loan.
And what happens if she drops below that 25K mark?
The penalty is swift. She may not execute any day trades until she deposits enough cash to get back above that $25,000 line. And as a quick piece of context for the listener, While FINRA actually repealed their specific PDT rule recently, CBO, the Chicago Board Options Exchange, still enforces this exact same margin standard.
Ah, okay.
So these numbers, the 4 trades in 5 days and the $25,000 minimum, are 100% testable on your exam.
Excellent context. So free riding equals a 90-day prepay freeze. PDT equals 4 trades in 5 days, requires 25K minimum, and blocks day trading if you drop below it. Know the difference.
You really have to keep those straight.
Finally, prudent Paula has had enough. She's done with the glitter, done with the margin calls. She tells Fiona, "We are closing your account. Take your business elsewhere." Fiona finds a new firm. How does the ACAT system work for transferring her assets?
ACAT stands for the Automated Customer Account Transfer Service. Once Fiona fills out the transfer form at her new firm and they submit it, the clock starts ticking for Paula. The carrying firm, Paula's firm, has exactly 1 business day to validate the instructions or take exception.
Taking exception meaning they find an error, right? Like Fiona misspelled her own name or the social security number doesn't match.
Exactly. And once Paula validates that the paperwork is correct, her firm has exactly 3 business days to complete the actual transfer of assets over to the new firm.
Here is a tricky scenario. Paula hates Fiona, but Reckless Rick loves the commissions she generates. Can Rick call Fiona during that 1-day validation window and say, "Wait, Fiona, don't leave. If you stay, we'll cut your options commissions in half." Can he stall the transfer to save the account?
Absolutely not. Customer retention is never a valid excuse to delay an ACATS transfer. It is considered anti-competitive behavior. Once that form is submitted, the firm must comply with the strict 1-day validation and 3-day transfer timeline.
1 day to validate, 3 days to transfer. Lock it in.
Yep.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We're going to finish up with a rapid-fire recap. I want high energy. If you are walking the dog or doing the dishes right now, I want you to say these answers out loud or in your head before the expert does. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
First up, inspection frequency for an OSJ and a supervisory branch.
Annually.
Inspection frequency for a standard non-supervisory branch?
Every 3 years.
Who has the authority to approve a brand new options account?
A registered options principal, or ROP, a GSSS, or branch manager.
But what if the branch manager doesn't have an options license?
Then they have 10 business days to get it approved by an ROP.
What is the trigger and the penalty for a pattern day trader?
4-day trades and 5 business days. It requires a $25,000 minimum equity at all times.
What is the penalty for free riding in a cash account?
A 90-day freeze, meaning all new purchases must be prepaid up front.
And finally, what is the difference between supervision and supervisory control?
Supervision establishes the playbook and the system. Supervisory control is testing if that playbook actually works and sending the report to senior management.
Boom, you are going to absolutely crush this section on exam day. Expert, give us a final thought to take away, something to chew on what we study.
I want you to think about the absolute secrecy of that SAR, the suspicious activity report we talked about with the glittery cash. To protect the global financial system from terrorism and cartels, your friendly local broker is legally mandated by federal law to lie to you by omission if you ask if they recorded you.
Wow.
It completely flips the standard fiduciary duty on its head. We spend so much time talking about how the broker must protect the customer. But the SAR rule shows us that sometimes, in the darkest corners of finance, the broker's ultimate loyalty is to the stability of the system itself, not the customer.
The invisible fortress will always protect itself first. I love that perspective. So what does this all mean? It means you now understand the mechanics and the why behind these rules, and you aren't just memorizing flashcards anymore. Happy studying, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.